I'm here in Lisniski and I'm talking to Ernie Clark. Ernie, you were born in 1951 here in the town?
No, I was born between Tempo and Enniskillen. So I was at a place called Mullinock, halfway between Enniskillen and Tempo.
When it got to the outbreak of the Troubles, at that stage, had you left home? No, you couldn't have. It was 1969. But what was your father doing for a living?
Mum and Dad moved to live in England to take the rest of the family away from. And I stayed at home with and was reared with my granny and granddad.
Where was that then?
That was in at Mullinock.
Oh, yes.
Because we were down in Belfast, and me two younger brothers came home from school one day. I was staying on at school in Enniskillen, but they came home from school and they told Mum that they were going down to the hall, which would have been Dundonald that evening, and they belonged to the one was in the Scouts and the other was in the Wolf Cubs. And she thought it was to do that, but when they went down, there was a UDA parade, mm-hmm. which they'd been told about in school, so Mum automatically brought them back up home and spoke, and within 3 weeks, he was worked in a dairy farm. He was over the dairy farm and they bottled their own milk. And the man in it had contacts in England, and it was losing him, but he still went across and he went to England, and that was the last. My mum came over to see me there because I haven't been that overly well myself at times, and she's 88 and she has Parkinson's, she has heart problems, but twice I had to put it off going across, so she came across there about 3 weeks ago to see me. And
imagine, yeah.
A wonderful woman, and, you know.
But you grew up with your grandparents.
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
And so your upbringing, you played all the games with the local lads.
And, yes,
and everything seemed very normal.
Yes, and left school very, well, didn't finish my exams, unfortunately. Went to school, or left school, and went to work in the cattle market in Enniskillen. Worked in it for quite a few years, so I did. And in 1975, I got married. And I was 23, my wife was 18.
What was your wife's name?
Phyllis.
And what was her maiden name?
Phyllis Kirkpatrick, and she came from Five Mile Town, where I'm now living.
Okay.
Have been since 76. Went back to school, so I did, the technical college, and done what I should have done. And when I came out of it, I joined part-time in Fermanagh. And I was in it for about a year and a half, left, went back to school, or when I got married, and then went to live in Five Mile Town. And in 1977, they came to me after Eva Martin was killed in the deanery. Her husband was the clerical officer, the civilian clerical officer, and
So who came to you?
A man in Five Mile Town that was a member, an officer in the UDR, and asked me what I think about joining and coming in and helping them, because he knew they needed someone in the office, and they knew that I could help them out that way. And I said yes, not what I was thinking when I'd went back to school what I was going to do, but I went and I helped them out. And when I was there, they asked me would I go to OMA. The colonel from OMA and this and that came up and spoke to me, and with recommendations that I got through PECO ones and this and that. And I transferred to OMA in April 1978, and I was there until I was discharged in 1992.
Oh, I see. And then for all that length of time, you were full-time UDR.
That's right, yeah. And from April 78 to 92, I was full-time in 6 UDR. And for a short period before that, before I was married, I was what they call Conrad, which was full-time, another name for it, in 4.
Did your wife then move with you up to Oma, or did you commute up and down?
No, I just commuted up and down every day.
I see. And describe those years to me.
In the early years of transferring to Oma or going to Oma, I really enjoyed them. They were good, but lost one friend, you lost another. And when I say friends from the Castle Derrick area, it got that there wasn't very rarely a month went past, but you weren't going to where someone was either killed or injured. And I worked in the orderly room at the time. I used to be brought in to do the reports on anything to record offices and all that. And it changed dramatically, and as I say, I was married in June of 75, and in September 1975, Uncle Sam was shot, which, as I said, was with me, lived with my granddad, and you can say he was like a brother. He was a brother, and his other brother, Uncle Willie, was blown up out the road here. Wasn't killed, but was injured. And I then, myself, coming back and forward from work, I noticed this vehicle following me, and I was followed. Okay, I reported to the police and done all that, and they came to me and stopped the person that was doing it. He was known, which I knew very well. I knew his name very well. I didn't know him very well now. But I personally didn't get any help.
I didn't get
any help from the regiment whatsoever. I was told to change routes. I was told to change times. However, the phone would ring, I need you in. And this happened, that happened. I had a bad car accident. In fact, we had two, the wife and I both, none of them of our fault. And I was had this leg broken in the arm. And I was even forced to drive in out over the mountain at Morley till my work in Oma using crutch.
Yeah.
To push the, what do you call it, down and drive with one hand. And as I say, then after with being followed, I was told this, told that. Within 3 weeks of that happening to me, the ones that followed me, with the information we were given, there could have been ending up to 20 murders in their hands.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And he never targeted anyone that he didn't assassinate, or whatever way, murdered, or whatever way you want to put it. But I was sitting at home, and it was a football, our football dinner was on that night, and I had just come back, and I was tired, and I wasn't in great form. I said to Phyllis, I'm not going, and I contacted them and said I wasn't going up. And then, as it used to come up, the news flash came up about an incident, Garrick Moore. I automatically thought it was another one of my friends, or one of the battalion, and rang in, and I know they can't give you anything on the phone. And all the fella said to me was, I knew him, he says, Ernie, it was your friend that wanted to go home with you.
Really?
And it's not one of the battalion. And he says, I'm saying nothing more other than that. Well, but to cut long story short, it was the man that followed me and his two associates, the three of them, went to, they were going till shoot one of our MT members that was driving part-time coal lorry, and it was the SAS, and they were shot. And I honestly think if it hadn't have been, I wouldn't have been here today, because they never targeted anyone that they didn't do. And, you know, it happened on, and then...
That's extraordinary. Yeah, but just can I just clarify that? So you were, for a number of times, leaving Oma to go home.
And vice versa.
And vice versa.
He would drive up to me bumper close. I would speed up. He would stay in me bumper. If I went down to 20 mile an hour, he wouldn't pass me. And if he knew the road, it's out over a mountain road. And
so if he really wanted to harm you, he...
But he was just setting up a pattern. What's the done?
Intimidating.
I wouldn't say intimidating. He was setting up a pattern to see where the best place would have been to hit me. And that's what I was told by information afterwards. That's what they done.
Yeah. And but what did that do to your mind? I mean, can you imagine the knowing that these people following you, you know, could kill you?
Well, it done quite a bit. I didn't bring anything home with me. What I mean by that, I never told the wife.
You kept it bottled up inside.
And I never, the kids, I have four of a family, the two oldest girls at the time, the two younger family don't really remember much about this.
So what year was this?
It had been in the 80s. Yeah. This would have happened to me. Because I know as well, I had a lassie working in the office with me, and I was going on my holidays, and she didn't really get on with the other ones other than me, that, well, I was her boss. And she says, no, I'm going back down to Castle Derg. I says, look, I'm only away 2 weeks. And she was what you call full-time, part-time, and if she wasn't there, she wasn't paid. And I'd done my best. I tried with other people to try and talk her out of it and do this and do that, because I thought the world of her. I was very close to her. She was like a daughter to me. And I was in the Isle of Man with, outside playing with my two kids to have her tea. And the wife came out and says, there's an incident in Castle Derg, and there's two dead, and one of them's a girl. I says, did it give names? She says, it did, but I'm not sure of it. I says, well, there's only two names I can think of. Would have been Heather Kerrigan that worked with me, or Sharon Coggan. She says, it's Kerrigan. And it was Heather was killed just 20 years, or just coming 20 years of age. I came home for that, and to this day, I know I shouldn't, everyone tells me I shouldn't, but still blame myself. If I'd have talked more to her and got her to stay, she mightn't have been, she was just blown apart.
Really? Yeah, and that was one of the, what bomb, where?
It was down at Castle Derg, on the Castle Derg border. Yeah. So it was, she went back to Rockwood and she went out onto the ground to do patrols, and she was with, her brother was very badly injured. And I think it was actually her uncle was the man that was with her, Loughlin, that was killed. I think it was an uncle of hers.
So was she... Was she in the wrong place at the wrong time, or do you think it was a deliberate?
No, it was their rape. Say, done the booby trap to kill them. Like,
So how do you pick yourself up after that and keep going? You know, you were still a UDR man. You were still on duty, and you were suffering some injuries from your car accidents. That didn't deter you either, did it? Or
no one, I'll be honest with you, as I say, I told you I worked in the office, then I took over the accounts and done the all the accounts and the clubs and all that, I wouldn't have been on the road as much as other people would have.
Yeah.
But I had done that part too, like, but I didn't do it as much as other ones. But I got it, it's difficult. I got to, especially working on the pay side of life, everybody would have come through you at some stage, especially from the recruits, and you set the thing up. And you, I got to know them all, and you seen them as young lads, such as young Roxburgh, 19 years of age. Sorted them all out, went to Ballykinner, came back, set his wages up, and he was blown up at Ballygolly. And that particular day, I was in the office of the Ballygolly bomb, and all the parents and husbands and wives were coming in to try and get some verification that heard of the bomb. But there was about 14, 15 Land Rover loads going to Ballykinner, and it was the back one, and we couldn't tell anyone until the police verified exactly who, whether ones that were killed, but we had verified every other Land Rover.
Yes.
We knew before the police could verify it. Like, we had to, it was waiting quite a while because one of them, it was his dentist records, was all he could be identified by. And I was sitting with the girl that worked with me in the office, giving Roxy's mum and dad tea and coffee and trying to relax them and tell them everything was all right. And I knew their son was dead.
Yeah.
So it, and it, I couldn't say anything. And things like that, you just can't, you won't get away from it.
And so this was happening all the way through your time in OMA.
Yeah.
What about the OMA bombing?
I wasn't in at the time, believe it or not, the OMA bombing. I was on the Liverpool boat on the way home when that actually happened. The wife and I, two of the kids, which at that stage had grown up. My youngest son's 27 now, and he's in, had three girls, but he's in Australia.
Yeah.
But that's where I was on it. And like, I was trying to keep in contact around certain ones, because there's a good part of that boat journey, you don't get reception. And when I got past Isle of Man, I was ringing once to see what was coming through. And to be honest with you, no, there wasn't anybody other than those that was in close work. And they told me how bad it was, they knew that. But, you know, I was out when that actually happened.
But tell me, Ernie, in all that length of time, so you were trying to keep this away from, remind me, your wife's first name again is
Phyllis.
You were trying to keep this away from Phyllis, and so it must have, I mean, every one of these terrible deaths must have affected you each time, and so it would all build up. And had you anybody that you could talk to, or
really, you had your mate or your mates that was beside you and worked with you.
Yeah.
We would have talked through it at the time, but even after I came out, I struggled. When I say I struggled within myself. And I got to a stage where I knew I had problems, because I would have shouted. If Phyllis said something to me, I could have snapped back, or the kids. I realised I had done it. I would go upstairs and be fit to come back down, maybe a lot of the times in 15 minutes, half an hour, and say, look, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I was never questioned on it. Which they were probably trying to do their bit. Phyllis would have known that there's probably things which, you know, you knew about the ones my mate's been killed and this and that. And then I had a friend from, he would have been my adjutant from combat stress, had left, had retired and was in combat stress, and he came to the house to see me a couple of times. He says, I'm getting you sent across on a holiday. I says, I'm going on no holiday. I says, there's ones...
Yeah.
Deserve had a lot more than me, and he sat down. He says, look, I know what's going on with you, haven't spoke to you. He tried to get me to go and work with him, and unfortunately I can't. I'm not saying I couldn't work, but I couldn't give a person a good day's work because I cannot still keep my concentration.
Yeah.
I could be in the middle of doing something, or writing something, and I go sort of a blank, I set it down, if I come back again, I wouldn't know where I was, and things like that, you know. But
talk to me about the time that, you know, you were followed in that. Did that continue? Or were you ever actually, were you fired on? Were you ambushed?
No. As I say, all he was doing was following to get me movements, me timings, and then they would have worked out anywhere on a 17 to 18 mile journey every day.
And you managed different tours every time, different ways home.
Yes, I took different roads there and back. However, there was always a part of it I had to be on.
Yeah, of course.
And it wasn't easy.
Oh, I'd say not.
But, you know, there's an awful lot of things happen. I'm being honest to you, the one thing that really lets me down is what happened from the regiment care and this and that. Like I saw it from upstairs, saw lads being forced to go out on the road and their best friend maybe killed the day before. That shouldn't happen. It shouldn't have happened. I watched it, and if they'd been disobeying an order, they'd been charged, they would have been possibly put out. It was a terrible place to work at the end. I was glad to get out. The only thing that saved it after I got out, there was an amalgamation. Those two came together, and I think it was a lot better. It would have been Fermanagh and Tyrone at 4 and 6, as they would have been. But they then transferred from UDR to the Royal Irish in 1992 in February, and I was only there for about 5 months of that.
Yeah. But when you were in the UDR in Omagh there, you think that there was maybe they weren't as efficient, that they weren't capable of managing the
Not saying no, to be honest with you, the lads on the road, the people who were training them and out over them, it was just a few personalities that actually took them on them, and they got their simplest way of putting it, put their nose in everything and ran everything and were allowed to do so. It just was not a happy place. Unless your face fitted exactly with that person, to me, you were in trouble.
So you were Church of Ireland, am I right in saying that?
No, Presbyterian. Sorry.
You're Presbyterian. Sorry,
quite correct. I was born and brought up Church of Ireland until I got married in 1975, and my wife was Presbyterian, so I go where my wife goes.
Right, and so talk to me then about was there any Roman Catholics in there in the UDR? Yeah, any members?
My best mate to this day is Roman Catholic.
Yeah,
and
who? What's his name?
Martin McCauley.
Oh, and was he there with you?
I was instigator. The adjutant asked me when he's another clerk, and he says, can you think of anyone, or do you know anyone that we could train to bring through? And I suggested Martin, which was down on the guard, or one of the MPs at the time. And he came on, he took over from me as chief clerk, he was adjutant's clerk, and all after I left. He then went to work for Combat Stress, and he's only retired there not that very long ago.
And so was he seen as a threat being a Catholic there or working at that time?
There's no point in telling a lie in me own it. This is my opinion.
Yeah.
There would have been ones, yes. would possibly not have trusted Martin because he was Roman Catholic. Personally, if I'd have been going out anywhere, the one man I'd have wanted beside me would have been Martin. I really, you know, and as I say to this day, I'm still good friends with him.
And what about the other?
There was other ones in, yeah.
And they would also trust him just as...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, which if not a nicer person you couldn't have met. Like, and he, since Martin even went out, he took a role with Combat Stress. He'd done the whole of Ireland, may I say. He used to go down to from Gordon Dodds when Gordon passed away. He would have flown down to Cork, you know, to meet ones there, Cork, Dublin and all that, that had their problems and all. Martin done the whole of Ireland. He was very good. Great lad. Unfortunately, Combat Stress, everything moves on. They've done away with that now too, the welfare side of things. They expect everybody to be fit to go into an office in Belfast. People in rural areas here at the moment love to see, get that letter, Martin's coming to see you on Wednesday.
Yeah, imagine, yeah.
And that's not happening, you know.
Do you think it was a sectarian war, or do you think it was... Do you think it was... what kind of a conflict or war, if you'd like to call it, or violence?
I wouldn't call it a war for a start off, because in a war, two people comes out to fight each other, and that didn't happen. It was tiresome. And... I don't know. I don't think at the end of the day it was political. It started off with civil rights, which, I'll be honest with you, wouldn't have been ashamed I was at and attended some of the civil rights things, because I agreed with what they were saying, you know, housing should be equal and all this should be equal, and the civil rights were okay, but it was infiltrated by the IRA. And that's where it went from there. Like, you couldn't be a part of it. That's where, to me, the divide took into it. The civil rights would have been mixed. Not 50-50, I don't mean it in that way whatsoever. But a lot that would have had the same thinking that everybody should have the same rights, and rightfully so.
And so did you have the same thinking that...
There's no reason why I should get a house, and if you're Roman Catholic, I had no kids and you had three, that I should get it in front of you. Well, to me, that's logical thinking. Like, you have to, you know, things like that, religion shouldn't come into it. You know, and told heartedly agreed with that, but it did happen.
Yeah.
There's no point in telling a lie, it did happen. And I'll be honest with you, if the civil rights had been... got going on, this is again my own honest opinion, and John Hume, Seamus Mallon, and at that time Trimble, Faulkner and them, I think they could have. I think possibly some of them jumped too quick onto Mr. Faulkner and put too much of pressure on him. Too much too quick that he could do anything. But as it went on and Trimble was there, if it had been left to that, I think we could have had maybe 30 years less violence, 20 years anyhow, if the first agreement had got going on, because it was SDLP and Unionists. And to me, both of them were more, I'm talking about the people of that day, were more level-headed. And then you had your DUP and Sinn Féin coming here, or Sinn Féin, and they kept saying no to everything.
Yeah.
And it brought round another 20 years of violence. And then those two crowd, when they got to be the biggest thing, they sat down together and squeezed the other ones out and have full control, and they can't even speak to each other. So anyone tells me that we are farther forward now than we were 30 years ago, I personally think we have went back. Because I do honestly think, you know, John Hume, Seamus Mallon, all them, and your unionist leaders at that time, if you'd been walking up the street, any moderate of any kind could have spoke to either of them on that side. Now that even a moderate's not going to a moderate union's not going to talk to your Sinn Féin because of the way they talk, or vice versa.
But I'd love to have been a fly on the wall inside in your office there, and it must have been during the height of the Troubles. It must have been a very tense place to be in, you know. So how did they say, for example, on a routine day, I mean, you go into the office, you're in there at what time? 9 o'clock in the morning?
Or heading from 8 to 9, yeah.
And what exactly was your brief? What were you doing?
Well, office work is as simple as this. You went in, the only time you were called in for briefs was if an area you're coming through,
yeah,
there was activity and you weren't allowed to go into it, that you had to go around another way or this and that, you were briefed on your own security and the threats of the time. You were given all that, and that was it. But as far as the work was concerned, in the office, it was the same as any office.
Yeah.
It was from day to day, what come in had to be dealt with and all that, you know, work-wise that way, it wasn't too bad.
So was it part of recruiting and paying officer or paying UDR? I mean, was your job payroll or was it...?
On the first half of it was office. And as I say, when an incident happened, you were called in. The records offices, this had to be notified, that had to be notified. Signals sent here and sent there and done all that, and you had to do an accident report on it, or an incident report, and you had that to do.
And you were facing with that every day, for a lot of the time.
Yeah, for quite a bit of it, yeah.
Yeah, and so to me that sounds like real conflict, real...
Well, don't get me wrong, it would test anyone. There was at times, you know... Yeah, I questioned myself. But for instance, when my Uncle Sam was shot, and it was the
second... What were the circumstances behind his death?
Monaghan Garda contacted Dungannon Police Station and asked them to go out and report a death.
Yeah.
And it was the height of the Troubles. And Uncle Sam was going out, but he had to wait. And this Sergeant Maxwell came in off duty and should have been going off. He says, I'm just waiting on someone to go out with me. He needed another person, or whatever the case may be. He says, Sam, and now the death sergeant told me at his funeral that he was in a bad way. He says, Sam says, owing to the political thing and where we are going, would it not be possible to ring the priest in the area and ask him to deliver the message?
Yeah.
And the death sergeant says, look, Sammy, go out and do it. It came from the guards. And he went out, and if you'd see it, he drove in, and the hedges was up that height there, and they just shot down into the car. Sam was driving it. Sergeant Maxwell, by the way, which was Roman Gallagher, was sitting beside him, and they shot from both sides of the bank down into the car, had an earthly.
And so where? What was the area?
It had been Pomroy, that direction. In the area, it's on the... It would have been the old Ballygolly line. You'd have turned into the right at Quinn's Bar.
Yeah.
It was way up in the country up there.
My goodness. Was he Sam Clark?
Yeah. And he... left a wife and three young kids.
Yeah. And so go back anyway.
He was 53.
Imagine. Yeah. And so go back, you were saying that you discovered that, and then what happened?
Well, on the night it happened, two other brothers and myself and Granda, his dad, we went down to Dungannon and seen him, you know, as I say, they've just fired into him, but it was one bullet that went in here, cut something in the neck that actually done the whole harm. But I can still remember it. Like, I come out, your days, this is the only way to put it, you know, you're trying to think this is not happening, it's not there. And I went outside and I remember Granda, this was at Dungannon, and I remember him coming out and putting his arm around me and went for a walk a couple hundred yards and came back up again. And I was young, I was 23 years of age, I was married a few months before. And Granda says, there's one thing I want you to promise me, because I say the troubles was terrible at the time, and he put his arm around me and he says, please, please don't you get involved in anything or think of any retaliation for Uncle Sam. He says, Uncle Sam wouldn't want it and I certainly don't want it. So please, because there was a lot of young ones and that's how they got them in on both sides. And I can be honest, it was said to me to try and draw me in a couple of places, and just ignored it, went on. And
to try and draw you into
an illegal organisation that could really, go and do, you know, we'll go and take someone out of it for Sam.
Yeah.
But I still will be very thankful for my granda, because I would never have went against him.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't been said to me, I'm not saying a word, I don't think I would, but you never can tell. And you know, there's a lot of things that you can draw on through all the different things that has happened, you know, and that's one of them as well. You know, my granda says no, and thankfully I listened to what he told me.
Yeah, I know. It's an incredible story, your story. I mean, when you think of the number of people who were so close to you who were killed, and I can still see it still affects you, it's still in you, you know, you can see you find it hard to talk about it, but it's important to get these stories, and these personal stories are so important to record.
I do honestly think a lot is, but once again it's from my own experience, in the way that you are brought up. Because the way I was brought up in a household where it would have been mixed people coming in, because I'm going back then, and they called it Killian.
Mm-hmm.
There was never a night, but there was someone in your house, and neighbours and this and that, and if you wanted someone from a neighbour's house, you went and didn't even have to ask for it. If it was there, you took it and done it, and that's the way it worked. And we were from mixed, but my granddad was a postman, first started off, and was on a bicycle, done quite a bit around the area, and he'd been very well known. My granddad was an orange man, a black man, and whatever it was. My uncles, which was half-brothers, brothers, would have been reared with him in the way I would have looked at it, but they would have been as well. But I never was told that I should join the Orange Lodge, I should join this lodge, or I should do that. That was left up to me. And personally, I didn't. Yeah. I'm not saying if anything against them, but it just, it wasn't me. And I didn't do it. But I never was put under pressure by any of them.
Yeah.
That was left entirely up to me.
Yeah.
And I honestly think, and I've tried to do it with my own kids, and hopefully I'm succeeding. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not doing too bad. They are the same. You have to, when they come in age, they have to be fit to think for themselves.
Of course.
Instead of this, you must. Like, I've known families lose sons and daughters because they come home with a different religion. My wife and I spoke about this when our first kid was born. She was 39 in October there. That wouldn't happen to us. As long as they were happy.
Yeah.
That's the way I want it. And I have one daughter, she's getting married the 18th of March, which is a wee boy of 8-10 weeks, because she was getting on. They decided this is the way to do things nowadays. And she's living down in Leitrim. and it would be a mixed marriage. But I hate saying that, because I don't believe it's a mixed marriage. I think it's a great marriage, because the two of them are very fond of each other. They have a great wee kid. I tend my love to pieces. Yeah. And I can't see any difference in Porrick coming through my door than my other son-in-law, which isn't Roman Catholic. Quentin, I think the world of him too. But to me, as long as my two daughters are happy,
yeah,
and are in marriage, that they are happy, and that's what I want life to be. But
yeah,
unfortunately, it'll never be in my day. I cannot see it.
Yeah. Ernie Clark, thank you for telling me your story. Thank you very much.
No problem. I'm sorry.